History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. What we've learned is that they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take that initiative to ask a few questions. And then to listen patiently enough to soak in some newfound perspective as memories from long, long ago take on new meaning in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The journey that we get to go on today with 99-year-old George Madera of Gustine, California, is one that starts out on the East Coast in the Prohibition era, moves all the way to the Azores, then back to America because of World War II, through Italy and Greece and the war, and finally to a fateful post-war choice to decline lung surgery, a decision that would forever alter his and his family's destiny.
I was born in Massachusetts, New Bedford, Mass. And then was during the 1930s, the Depression was not too good then at that time. And my parents, they decided to go to the Azores. I was only 6 years old. So we went, and my father had done well. Although there was a Depression, he had an alcohol business, which was against the law at that time. But it was either do that or go on a soup line.
So your father was a bootlegger, as they called it, during Prohibition?
Yes, he was. So it was either doing that or go on a soup line. They used to call it a soup line. No jobs, you know.
Yeah, tell us about that, because most of us haven't lived through that. What were some of those things you remember seeing in those early childhood years?
Well, there's a little, I have a picture over there that I can show it to you, where my father had the business. Okay. It was just the front. It was looked like a sandwich bar, you know. I used to love to go over there because there was a bowling lane, one bowling lane. But at that time, the balls were small. They were not the big ones. I used to love to go over there because I used to like to play with the balls. So anyway, my father had a room where there was a poker room, like, where they drink and play cards and illegal stuff. And they had a store in the front, was just like a sandwich bar, you know. So he decided, things were bad. He decided to go to some, and he built a home, which is over there, picture. Over there in San Miguel, which is the largest island of the Azores. So we went over there, but my parents didn't last long. My mother passed away, she was about 34 years old, and my father was only 46.
Wow.
So I had a sister and two brothers. Mm-hmm. My sister was the oldest one, she took care of us. So when I reached between 16 and 17 years old, was during the Second World War, and the Portuguese army government was threatening to take me in the Portuguese army. I said, no, I'm an American citizen. I'd like to be an American army. So I decided to come. I was only about pretty close to 17. I came with a younger brother of mine. He was younger than I was, about 3 years old. So I came to an uncle that was in New Bedford. And from there, I was inducted to the Army.
Okay, and I want to ask you some more questions about this, because most of us haven't had an experience like this, right? And first of all, not to dwell on your father during Prohibition, but this is what they call a speakeasy? Is that what it was?
Yes, that's what they call it.
And did you know what was going on, or you were just
Well, I don't know much about what was going on. I know he was doing okay, you know.
So then they just come to you one day and say, hey, we're moving to the Azores?
Yeah. And we all went, and he had done well. So he figured the depression was still going on in New Bedford at that time. So he built a nice home over there, and he had a little farm, but he didn't last long. Like I mentioned it to you, my mother passed away, was only 2 days. And my father was about 46, 47.
Well, I'm just trying to put myself in your shoes. That must have been a big life change, going from the U.S. to the Azores and leaving your friends behind and all that.
Yeah. Well, I was in kindergarten, so I didn't have many friends.
So what about life in the Azores before World War II?
I graduated from grammar school over there. Then I went to Punta Delgada, which is the city, the largest, the capital of the Azores, in fact. And I went to school, a special school that was agriculture. And I went over there, and I went about 3 or 4 years, pretty close to 4 years. A teacher, Domingos Rovell, a very famous, the most famous Portuguese painter. Paintings all over, I'll show you. He was like that painter from Spain, Picasso. He was the Portuguese Picasso at that time, because he was the most famous Portuguese painter.
So when we look at this box that you got in the hospital at the end of World War II, and you've done this sculpture or carving on the top of it, is that from some of his instruction? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, I did learn some, not too long. I didn't spend too much time with him because I came to the United States. And then I never heard any more about him. So he was already pretty old. So that was it. Then I decided to come to the United States. That's because of the government, Portuguese government was threatening to put me in a Portuguese army. So that's how I decided to leave. And I didn't know much of the United States. But I went to my uncle. As soon as I turned 18, I was inducted to Florida for basic training, and then Italy. I landed in Naples about pretty close to midnight. I had to jump in a foxhole because some German planes came over. The alarm came on, but it was just for a short time. The alarm came on again, and they had barracks for us. That's when I spent about a year over there in Italy till I was transferred to the engineer company.
Well, and sorry for all my little detours here. I'm just, you know, every veteran's story is unique, and I've talked to people who grew up in a lot of places, but I've never thought about the Portuguese army in World War II.
Yeah, Portugal was neutral, but still they had problems with Africa. We had a colonies. There are two colonies, Angola and Mozambique was Portuguese. And there were army to maintain the government, the Portuguese government. So that's when they were using a lot of soldiers, so they threatened me, so I didn't want to do that.
And the other piece of this, you know, people go to Hawaii for a week and they get island fever because they're so far from the mainland. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people don't realize how far the Azores are from the Portuguese mainland. I mean, you're kind of out in the middle of nowhere, aren't you?
It is. But I was healthy, and when I came to New Bedford again, and I was inducted, I done well. And then, like I mentioned before, Italy first for a little bit over a year, and then 8 months in Greece.
But I think you told me before, when you were heading overseas, you thought you were going to North Africa, right?
Yes, on a ship. That I read that they were going to North Africa, but then things changed, and they decided to go with this ship to Italy, which was Naples, when I mentioned to you that we landed in Naples about pretty close to midnight.
Well, and what about the days and weeks that followed? What kinds of things did you see and experience?
Well, in Naples, was the experience was considered a front line because they, like I mentioned, I had to jump on a foxhole because the alarm came on that some German planes were coming overhead. And after it cleared, I went from Naples to Civitavecchia. That's another city, pretty close to Rome. But Rome was still with Germans occupying it. So in Civitavecchia, that was the Second World War encounter that I had. And they gave me 2 stars on my, I had ribbons. I had about 4 ribbons. And I had 2 stars, and they were stole for, was from being on the front lines twice, once in Naples and once in Civitavecchia. From there, like I mentioned, I went to Greece on an engineer company.
Well, and I want to dive a little deeper on some of this, because, again, most of us haven't experienced some of these things.
Civitavecchia was pretty bad because it was all mines, full of mines. In fact, I heard at that time they had a strip that they had cleared for us to walk on. And one time we were walking, and one of the guys, he wanted to pee. He stepped on the wrong place because the mine went up and blew his foot. So that was one of the... And I saw one time a wild dog was walking, and they had little wires. And I mentioned this friend of mine. I said, he's going to set one of the... And sure enough, he did. And some of the shrapnel was flying close to my ears. I was lucky that I was not hit by it. But that was the closest I came to getting a Purple Heart. I never did.
Well, we're thankful for that. And you talk about mines and booby traps. And, I mean, that to me, that would make me kind of nervous to go anywhere, right? I mean, you never know what you're stepping into.
I know. I even went to, this was a huge hotel that was abandoned by that, and we were taking care of it, you know. And I remember going in the basement and seeing a box of Red Devils was and grenades. And I was lucky I didn't get blown up with it. But I picked a couple and I threw it on the ocean, and some of the fish came up. But I stopped fooling around with that because I was scared. So that was one of the things that happened while I was over there.
Well, and if you were in those kind of situations, I mean, I have to imagine you saw a lot of things that nothing could have prepared you for. Did you have to deal with guys that you knew getting killed or wounded?
Well, there was one of the friends that was walking with me. He got wounded from a shrapnel from one of the booby traps that we set up. He got on a foot. So he was happy because that meant he was getting a Purple Heart, and you get so many points for that.
Right.
So he was happy about that.
Sounds like that was one of those million-dollar wounds, they called them?
Yes, it was. So that was it.
George Medeiros wasn't wounded in World War II, but he would spend 3 months in the hospital at the end of the war. We'll hear about that and why he's actually thankful for that episode today because of what it led to. And before we're done, we'll hear about his recent honor flight to Washington, D.C. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,500 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with 99-year-old George Medeiros of Gustine, California. Originally from New Bedford, Massachusetts, followed by more than a decade in the Azores, George chose to return to his native USA as opposed to being drafted into the Portuguese Army during World War II. Our Army sent him to Italy and then Greece. So both your parents had passed before you even went into the service. Did you hear from your sister or anyone while you were overseas?
Yeah, I at that time was hard to write because they didn't want to let the enemy know about your mailing, where it was going. And what. But when I was coming from Portugal to the United States, I came on a Portuguese ship. It was a cargo ship, but they had room for 12 passengers, and I was one of them. And I was told if I was stopped by a German submarine to make believe that I was one of the workers, because otherwise they would take me in because I was coming to the United States. But we were lucky we were never stopped by a German submarine. So that was one of the scares.
Yeah, like I said, you've been through some stuff in your life that most of us haven't been. So, you know, you said you were in Italy for close to a year. That's a long time. You must have seen some of the evidence of war, some of the devastated towns. Or
German prisoners passed by us, you know, and things of that sort. And we had fixing some of the buildings. When I was transferred to the engineers, we were fixing some of the buildings close to the front line to accommodate for the Americans who get wounded. They had a place to go to.
And let's talk about that, switching from an infantry outfit to an engineer battalion. How did that happen, and how did you feel about it?
Well, I was happy in a way because I heard so much about the infantry going to France, and they did go to France. There were rumors already that we were going to France. So I was happy that I didn't go. Instead, I went to Greece because then they had a strip for the planes to land. Mm-hmm. We went over there to extend that strip, airstrip, in Greece. So that's when I spent 8 months there. 1945, when the war ended, and that's when I came home.
And I believe that airstrip that you extended, that's an airstrip that the Nazis had been using, right?
I don't know too much about that part. But I do know that they needed it to have the big planes to be able to land, and they didn't have an airstrip long enough to accommodate them.
Maybe you can help us understand, too, just the day-to-day, because you were over there, you know, in wartime for quite a while. Where'd you sleep? What'd you eat? What was the day-to-day life like?
We had tents. Uh-huh. They were built over there before we arrived. And there was about 6 to each tent that we slept on. So that's in Greece.
What about before that, as you made your way through Italy?
In Italy also we slept in tents. And at that time, everything was, the food was like potted potatoes, potted eggs. was not too good. Because everything was powder, looked like it. So I was happy to, when we went to the engineer, things changed, even the food.
And how did you get along with the other guys in your unit?
Oh, pretty well. I never had any problems. Yeah, we done pretty well with it.
I'm just wondering about that because I've talked to a lot of veterans from a lot of different backgrounds. And, you know, at the time the military was segregated, all the African Americans by themselves, the Japanese Americans.
I didn't have any blacks on it. It was a mixture of Italians, Irish, different, but most of them white.
Were you the only one from the Azores?
Yes. And I couldn't speak too much English. I still have a problem. But at that time, it was a huge problem. But I was forced to learn.
Did anybody make fun of you or pick on you because of that?
Well, little jokes like, you know, here and there. But I learned to take care of that. Mm-hmm. So I done pretty well.
Did they have a nickname for you or anything?
No, it was just Medeiros.
What was the hardest thing for you with all that time in the Army? What was the most challenging part of it for you?
Was in Italy when I landed. That was the hardest part. And Civitavecchia too, when I was transferred to Civitavecchia. Because those mines and everything were always very dangerous to step on out of the cleared places. Very bad.
And I don't know if this is an easy question to remember back this far and think about, but when you were going overseas, did you think about whether or not you'd come home? Was there a thought, hey, I might not make it back?
I thought I wasn't going to make it back. I really did. And I saw I didn't have anybody to, when I left on the train to go to Florida. The other ones, they had their families and everything, but I was all alone. But I was able to adjust and take care of myself. It was hard because I saw the other ones with the families and I didn't have anybody. But thank God I done well. And I came home.
Yeah.
I was blessed.
How much did you interact with the civilians, whether in Italy or Greece or wherever?
I don't know well with the civilians because we had civilians working for us on repairing some of the buildings. You know, I don't know well with the civilians. They respected us, at least my unit, and we got along real well.
Did you ever have any funny experiences in the Army, things that made you laugh?
Well, I had some time off, you know, and I used to go out and try to meet the people, especially girls, because I was only 20, between 20 and 21. So that was an experience. I did meet some of the people. They used to come to us and ask, can I take you to have breakfast? Because they knew that we had like a powdered eggs, and so they used to tell us to have, they had a good place to take me to have breakfast with real good breakfast. So that was about it. I had a captain, a very good person, because one of the times, you know, was really, really hot, and me and the guy used to smoke. I don't smoke any longer. And me and the other guy, we thought we'd go and sit in the shade, take a break, because it was hot. So we were sitting down, and just suddenly I see these nice shoes coming along. I figured it was an officer. So I looked up, it was a colonel checking on us. So we stood up, saluted him. He asked for our serial number, because we had numbers. And that was it. But nothing happened. I was surprised because I asked the sergeant that was in the office. I said, hey, didn't you get something about this colonel? He says, yes, we did. I did, but my company said, no, our officer is going to punish my men. And he told the sergeant to throw the report on a wastebasket. So I was really, I thought I was going to be maybe doing foxholes or something, punished, you know, to do something. Mm-hmm. But no, that was the closest I get to be in trouble. But I tried to go by the rules.
You know, you mentioned the first night you got there having to dive in a foxhole because it was an air raid. What were some of the other hazards that you had to deal with along the way? Did you have like enemy artillery coming in? Were you dealing with sniper fire? Were there other things?
There was a lot of fire going up, mm-hmm. and it was a lot of focusing, searchlight to try to. I did see the plane, but it was coming pretty high, and they were shooting up. We were shooting up.
Did you ever get a sense for what it meant to the people of Italy to have you guys there liberating them from Mussolini and that regime?
Yes, we did. Some of them, they recognized that, and they welcome us, and they very pleasant people. You know, I didn't have no problem with the population.
The other thing that came to mind for me, you know, because I grew up with a lot of Azorean Portuguese friends, and Portuguesa isn't too different from Espanol,
yeah.
And Italiano isn't too far off either.
No, not the northern part of Italy.
Yeah.
Was very easy to get to talk to. They have different dialects. I'm going to tell you one example is when I was transferred to the other unit. I was in charge of equipment, and they used to come and ask me for nails. In Portuguese, it's pregos. So I said, pregos? They said, no. I showed them all, they said, pontilhos. I said, okay, but pontilhos. So it happens that when we went to Civitavecchia, they came and asked me for nails. And I said, oh, pontilhos. They said, they looked at it and said, they said, no, it's pregos. I said, I get mixed up. I said, oh, no. So this was from the northern part, was more similar to the Portuguese language than the south. Naples was very hard, but up northern part, it was easy.
Are there some things, you know, maybe some sights, some things you witnessed, some events or places that you can still see in your memory now? You could picture being there or seeing this or that?
I went, when we had a chance to time off, I went all over Rome, and I went to the ancient Calcium. I visited that, and a lot of forts and lots of museums and things like that. I did quite a bit. I enjoyed that.
Well, if there's anything else about your time overseas, I'd love to hear it. But also coming back to the States after all that, what was that like?
It was not easy because I came back, I got sick. And while I was in Italy, I got huge cough and bleeding through my mouth. And they even put me in the English hospital for about a week to rest, mm-hmm. because they didn't have an American, because it was... Greece was occupied by English, so they had an English hospital. So they sent me to an English hospital. And I was over there about a week. I drank a lot of tea. Every few minutes it would give me tea.
That sounds like a kind of scary to not understand what's going on with your lungs and everything.
And then when I came to the United States, I broke up again. That's why because I was in love with this girl. I was fully, again, I started coughing and bleeding. I was wanted to go to school to take a high school diploma and maybe to be a pharmacist. So I was going on the GI Bill of Rights, going to school. But the teacher, she saw me coughing and bleeding. She called the army nurses division, and they sent me to pick me up, and they took me in to test me, and they thought I had tuberculosis. So I spent 3 months in the hospital over there, Rutland Heights, and they were ready to operate on me, on my lung, because they discovered I didn't have TB. So I went to another hospital to be operated on. I had bronchiectasis, spots on my lungs. So it was to remove that. So this young doctor called me in his office before all the tests were made, and he showed me the what was wrong with me. He said, "If I'm going to remove all that, these spots, you won't have much left of lungs." I said, "Well, what would you do if you were in my place?" He said, "I wouldn't do it." I said, "I'm not going to do it." "Then what do you recommend?" He said, "To go to a place where far away from big bodies of water, warm place, that you would do much better." So I said, "Well, I was doing good in St. Michael, Azores. Is you're not going to do well because it's an island and it's damp and all that. And I'm still going to go. I'm going to try it." I went. He was right. I was coughing a lot and bleeding. Then I told my brother-in-law. I had a brother-in-law married to my sister that took care of us. And he was in a seminary to be a priest. But then he changed when he met my sister and he got married. And I told him about what the doctor had told me. He says, "When I was in a seminary, I met this, he's a priest now and he's in California. Maybe I got to get in contact with him. Maybe he can help you." He did. He found out from his family that he wrote to him, and he said, "Send him over." So I came over to California all alone. I didn't know a soul. I came to this priest. He was in Turlock, and that's how I came to California. I didn't know anybody. This priest knew a family from one of the towns close to the one over there in St. Michael. So I went to this family, and they took me in, and I was start working in a creamery. And I wish I had kept the address of this young doctor, because I started doing well immediately.
And wait until you hear the wild story of how he connected with his wife of 72 years, Odilia. It's time for our final break. You can find photos and a short video with George Medeiros online at hometownheroesradio.com or on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend. It's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is. Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Every veteran story is unique, and 99-year-old George Medeiros of Gustine, California, has taken us on quite a journey today. When we left off, he had come to the West Coast after World War II in hopes that the dry air would be good for his lungs. And in California's Great Central Valley, he connected with another family with roots in the Azores.
So this family, they told me they had a family on St. Michael that they want to bring over to the United States. If I would go and marry the oldest girl, which was one of my wife's sister, a proxy, just to bring her over. So I look at the picture and I saw my wife. I said, "Oh, what if I was 26. I figured, well, I'm just about ready to get married, alive. So I said, "Oh, how about this girl? I'll go over there and marry the oldest one, But if I like this girl and she likes, if we hit it together, I'll marry her for good and bring the whole family. And that's what happened. And we still married. 3 months I met, 3 months later I got married. She accepted me. I got married and I brought the whole family over.
And maybe back then this was a little more commonplace. But for a lot of people listening, this is blowing their minds a little bit. So because you're from San Miguel, you get approached, say, hey, we know some people back there. Look at this picture. Marry this one so she can come to America. They're basically telling you, you don't even have to stay with her. We just want to get her here, right?
Yes.
But you look at the picture and you say, well, I don't know about the sister, but I like the little sister right over here, and I'll bring the whole family. And they said, that's a good deal.
Exactly. That's what happened. That's what happened. We still married for 72 years.
Well, but there's more to how that went. So then you had to go over there to meet her?
Well, I met her 3 months later. We got married, and I brought the whole family.
Were you a little nervous, though, heading over there? What's she really going to be like? What did I get myself into?
Well, I met her. I could see that she liked me. I said, oh, of course, I wanted to know if I would be accepted. She said, yes. And we both agreed on each other. And we got married over there, and that's when I brought the whole family over.
That's a pretty wild story, isn't it?
It is. But thank God I done well. I came over here with that family, and then I worked in a creamery. And whenever I had my intentions all the time to go on my own. I was working in a creamery. I had a pasteurizing license from the state. Mm-hmm. I was doing well too. I was earning a top bracket. I worked over there about 16 and a half years. So when I accumulated enough to buy a place, I did. And then I bought my wife a sewing machine. And I went to Modesto. She was taking lessons on it. And on this place that I bought 30 acres on a corner of Hunt and Preston, there was an old barn, and I didn't know what to do with it. So I said, I saw a USA poultry advisor, because I wanted to build a poultry house. And he told me, well, you have this barn. There's a demand for fryers. Maybe I can get you going on it. And he helped me to buy second-hand old equipment, and I went with Foster Farms. And I started in a poultry business. After the barn, I built three more chicken houses. I was raising over 50,000 layer. And I met a man that was in charge of raising pullets. And he asked me if I wanted to raise pullets instead of fryers. So the offer was better than the one I had. So I took him over. And he told me, he says, well, why don't you look in the place by the highway and have layers? So I looked up and I found the place 10 acres, about 10 acres, 9 point something. And I bought the place and I built the first egg ranch. I put a sign up and I done well. I was able to get pretty close to 300,000 layers, all automatic. And I was working in a creamery and I still had the old ranch, but I had high school kids to help me. And my wife, she was a great worker. I couldn't have done without her.
I'm just putting two and two together now, because growing up in Las Banas, I knew your nephew, Joe, and we used to get eggs from them every once in a while from the egg ranch. So I've eaten your eggs.
Like I mentioned, I was the first one to come over. After that, my brother came, which was the father of Joe. He brought the whole family, and there was my sister and the family. There were a lot of poultry people came over, and they went into poultry business because I had started and I was doing well. So they started doing that too.
Well, there's probably a lot of people out there listening who have eaten the eggs that came from that egg ranch. And how long did you stay involved with that?
Then I went on the almond business. I bought some property. I thought that would be good to use the chicken manure as fertilizer, but it was not all that great. But I liked the almonds. So I sold the poultry ranch, and I bought pretty close to 500 acres of almonds. But things, almonds business was growing like mad, and I thought they were not going to be doing too well. So I sold most of it, and I have 40 acres that I kept. That's the ones that I have right now, and I have it with my son-in-law. He takes care of it.
So, you know, we hear a lot about the immigrant success stories. Now, you were born in this country, but when you came back, you were all alone. Your parents were gone.
But I had in mind always to go on my own, so I was saving. And my wife worked on a cleaner, and we were both saving and putting the money away till I was able to buy this 30-acre ranch. That's when I started on a poultry business. My brother Joseph came over, and he also bought not far away from where I was. He bought a place.
This may seem like a dumb question, but, you know, something will be the in food, and then it gets villainized. So eggs were good, now they're bad. Then they're good, then they're bad. And almonds, they say, oh, it's too much water. No, but they're good for you. Those are a couple of the things that you've grown. I bet you've eaten a lot of both of those.
Yeah, I did. I was successful on both. I done a lot really good with the egg business, and I done real well with the almonds.
I was just wondering if maybe consuming those foods is part of your secret to still being so sharp.
Possibly, and that's, thank God I have a nice home, and I have enough to live comfortable with no problems, and I'm able to help my daughters and my son-in-law.
And I really don't want to be melodramatic, but I've been listening to the story and trying to pay attention, and it sounds like the best thing that ever happened to you was having bad lungs and having that doctor tell you that, you know, come out here.
Yes, you're right. That was the reason why I came over here to California.
But at the time, I bet you weren't thinking that's the best thing that ever happened to you.
I didn't, never came to my mind to come to California all alone because I didn't know anybody, mm-hmm. Nothing. And I didn't have any money, so I had just enough to get for the transportation. I worked in a factory in New Bedford, Mass for a little while, but there was enough to come over, and that was it.
Sometimes the things that are the hardest are the things that turn out best for us. And I want to talk to you about the honor flight, but, you know, first, you know, since if you didn't have that condition with your lungs, the doctor wouldn't have told you to come here, you wouldn't have met your wife, you wouldn't have had this whole life here on the west side of the valley. But 72 years of marriage, there's got to be a secret to that. How have you guys done that and still love each other so much?
Well, there's always disagreements, but we always ended up together in bed. Uh-huh. And that was great. That's one thing that my wife, she always, on the end, of the, she always agreed with me. And likewise, I did too. We did give in to each other, and we were able to stay together all this time.
Well, let's talk about this honor flight. What was it like to go to Washington, D.C. with all those other veterans and see those things you saw? What stood out to you?
It was great. I didn't expect to see what I seen. I met Speaker of the House at the Capitol. I was able to shake his hand, which was great. I've seen him on TV and all that. I always did like him, but when he took Pelosi's place, I was really happy. So I told him that. He smiled.
Well, what did that mean to you that all the representatives from this area, a couple of them whose roots trace back to the Azores like you, Costa and Valadao, Duarte too?
He spoke with me in Portuguese. I was surprised. I thought he wouldn't speak. But he said, no, I can speak a little bit, you know. I was born, you know, he mentioned he was born over here, but he had his parents. He says he was able to learn Portuguese. So I was really happy to see him too.
And for that building that's been such a part of so many historic moments, to have them have you and your fellow veterans as guests of honor there. What did that mean to you?
Great. I never expected to see all that in my life, especially on the end of my life. I never expect to see that and to be able to shake hands with the Speaker of the House. Fantastic.
What about when you went to the National World War II Memorial? And they have that wall there of 4,000 gold stars, and it says, "Here we mark the price of freedom." That's representing 400,000 Americans who didn't get to come home like you did. What were you thinking about when you were there?
I was able to take me and this. There was only two Second World War veterans. It was me and this other guy. He was a Navy man, but I was 1 year older than he was. And we were picked to take the reed of the unknown soldier. So that was a great honor to do that. That was a great, great trip. It was a dream trip, and I was happy and lucky to be on it.
Was there one moment in that whole honor flight experience that was the most enjoyable for you or the most meaningful?
It was one of the times of most enjoyable was to take that reed to the unknown soldier and to be able to salute it.
When you're there at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier or at the World War II Memorial that honors all those who didn't come home, is there any part of you that says, hey, that could have been me that didn't come home?
Oh, of course. My wife tells me that all the time. When she says, you know, you're really lucky not to be. Look at those guys with the suffering, and you came home doing great. I says, yes, I am blessed. I'm Catholic, and I carried the rosary with me all the time when I was in the army. I was in a foxhole. I was praying with that rosary. You believe in miracles, but I think I was also transferred at the right time to this engineer company. I don't know why, but I think that's why I'm over here today.
You were mentioning, you know, praying with the rosary in your foxhole. Do you still have that set of rosary beads?
I do. And I told my wife that when I pass away, I wanted to have it on my hands. And if anybody of the girls, my daughters, if they wanted it, they could have it. If not, I'd like to go with it to the grave.
Well, if there's anything else that's important to you, feel free to add. But I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us this story. I am interested to know, is there something that you would say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
Well, I'm thankful to be an American, to have been born in the United States, and to have served my country, and blessed to be able to come home, which was lots of them that were not able to. So I'm blessed for that. I have everything I need. I'm comfortable with my life and my family, and I thank you for everything.
That is George Medeiros, 99 years young, from Gustine, California. You can find photos of George then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. Thanks so much for spending this hour with us today. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you can tune in again next time when we'll be reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.